NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, GOP lawmakers in the House are debating the budget bill, which proposes substantial cuts to Medicaid. They claim it saves money, but it could actually cost taxpayers more by driving up Medicare spending and weakening the entire healthcare system. We talk with Doug Wirth of AmitaCare and Christine Aguiar Lynch of the Association for Community Affiliated Plans, two experts in the field, about why slashing Medicaid doesn't just hurt vulnerable populations. It shifts the burden to Medicare, strains provider networks, and sets off a chain reaction that affects everyone. The latest episode of Cats Cast, we're going out to the ball game, a revival of vintage baseball in Delaware County, plus the Pike County Stream Keepers. That's coming up, but first the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is on Capitol Hill this hour, meeting with House Republicans. He's urging them to vote for a GOP budget bill that includes spending for his domestic priorities. That includes extending tax cuts that will expire this year. Trump dismissed criticism that the proposed spending plan will hurt vulnerable Americans.
We're cutting three things: waste, fraud, and abuse. We're not changing Medicaid, and we're not changing Medicare. And we're not changing Social Security.
But the federal government's own investigations say that only about 5% of Medicaid payments are improper. The GOP budget would need a lot more cutbacks to reach its goals, and Democrats claim 8.5 million Americans could lose access to Medicaid under the plan. Separately, a handful of Republican conservative lawmakers don't like the bill either. They say it would add trillions of dollars to the federal debt over a decade. This hour, Secretary of State Marco Rubio is testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He once served on this panel. Rubio is expected to defend major cuts proposed for the State Department budget, saying America is back. But NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Democrats disagree and say the Trump administration is ceding influence.
The last time Rubio sat before his former committee was in January for his confirmation hearing, and he was approved unanimously. But this time around, Democrats are expected to raise objections about the way he's dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development. In her prepared remarks, Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire says the Trump administration has, quote, eviscerated six decades of American foreign policy investments, undercutting the nation's ability to compete with countries like China. She says while Rubio cut most U.S. foreign assistance, China has increased its diplomatic budget and is trying to present itself around the world as a more reliable partner than the U.S. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened lower this morning as Home Depot reported better-than-expected quarterly sales. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials fell about 60 points in early trading.
Home Depot says its U.S. sales inched higher in the first quarter as customers tackled home improvement projects. The company also says it's working to hold the line on prices despite President Trump's new tariffs. Last week, Walmart warned those import taxes will push its prices up. Other big retailers, including Target and Lowe's, are set to report earnings tomorrow. China's central bank is cutting interest rates for the first time in 7 months. The move is designed to boost spending in the world's second largest economy, which is under pressure from the trade war with the U.S. Stock in Chinese battery company CATL began trading in Hong Kong today. Its shares jumped more than 16%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 50 points. You're listening to NPR. The Department of Homeland Security says it sent a charter flight of migrants from Houston to Honduras and Colombia. The agency says 64 people voluntarily decided to self-deport back to their home countries. DHS says this was not a federal immigration operation. The migrants received travel help and a stipend of $1,000. But CNN is reporting some of the people sent out of the U.S. were children who are legal American citizens. Today is primary election day in the state of Pennsylvania. Voters are choosing candidates for some top jobs, such as mayor and district attorney. These races are drawing interest in cities such as Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Pennsylvania. A big barrier for people who want to start biking regularly is safety. NPR's Regina Barber reports on a new device that might help map out safer cycling routes.
Cycling can be seen by many as a great eco-friendly way of transportation, but it can be dangerous sharing roads with cars. To better understand which routes were safer than others, a team of computer scientists created a sensor to monitor how close cars get to cyclists. Over the span of 2 months in Seattle, Washington, 15 bikes were equipped with the sensor. During that time, the team recorded over 2,000 close passes from cars. These passes were compared to 5 years of bike collisions in the area, and locations of those close passes matched historically dangerous routes. The researchers hope to deploy more sensors in more cities where all of the crowdsourced data can feed into a map that helps anyone find safer bike riding routes. Regina Barber, NPR News.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As you just heard from NPR News, President Trump is on Capitol Hill right now to urge passage of a GOP megabill. He's trying to secure the votes of conservative lawmakers who say the bill would balloon the deficit and who also want substantial changes to Medicaid. Trump said the legislation's changes to Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, which have been predicted to result in at least 8.6 million Americans losing health coverage, weren't, quote, anything meaningful, end quote. But in New York alone, these proposals advanced by the Ways and Means and Energy and Commerce Committees would result in $3.1 billion in Medicaid reductions, jeopardizing care for over 1 million enrollees. Yesterday, Governor Kathy Hochul updated New Yorkers on the effect of several health care provisions in the Republican budget reconciliation bill. These provisions collectively amount to an annual loss of nearly $13.5 billion for New Yorkers and the health care sector in the state, jeopardizing health care access for millions while imperiling the state's hospitals and other health care providers, according to the governor. Joining us today are two leaders who understand the Medicaid and Medicare issue from the ground up. Doug Wirth is president and CEO of AmitaCare, New York's largest Medicaid special needs health plan, serving people with chronic conditions, behavioral health needs, and those who are duly eligible for Medicaid and Medicare. And Christine Aguilar-Lynch, vice president for Medicare and Managed Long-Term Services and Supports at the Association for Community Affiliated Plans, a national organization representing nonprofit safety net health plans serving Medicaid and Medicare beneficiaries. Doug, Christine, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Tim.
Thank you, Tim, so much. Thank you, Tim. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Doug, you co-authored an opinion piece in the USA Today Network about Medicaid cuts and how they will really increase Medicare costs. Let's just start off. What does that look like on the ground for seniors, people with disabilities, and those managing chronic illness, the real-world impacts of these Medicaid cuts on Medicare enrollees?
Thanks, Tim. You know, your opening really shined a light on the fact that the House Republican bill is not about fiscal stewardship, nor is it about taking care of Americans. It's about tax breaks for those amongst us who don't worry about the cost of eggs and groceries, gas for our cars, heat or cooling for our homes, or caring for elderly parents who have significant health care and support needs. Medicaid cuts are really cost shifting to the federal government. And a cut to Medicaid is not about savings. It's about a time bomb waiting to explode in terms of higher costs and actually costs that could be avoided.
Christine, do you have some comments there too on what real world impacts for folks are, and maybe any examples from your experience with dual eligible populations?
Yes. So again, I just want to say thank you, Tim. And this is such an important issue. And I agree with everything Doug said. And one of the things that we've been doing in our advocacy in D.C. is really trying to highlight exactly what Tim wrote in the op-ed, that a cut to Medicaid is a cut to Medicare. So to give you just some more specifics on that. So as anyone who is on Medicare is aware, you know, that Medicare doesn't cover everything, right? There are certain services such as vision, dental, hearing services that are not covered by traditional Medicare. There is also cost sharing and premiums that are part of the Medicare program. And Medicare does not cover long-term care services and support, but Medicaid does. So Medicaid covers all of those services for both low-income seniors and then also for people with disabilities that are not senior but are eligible for Medicaid because of their disabilities. So I think to answer your question, it's sort of two impacts directly on Medicare from a cut to Medicaid. One is that the low-income seniors and the individuals with disabilities that are on both Medicaid and Medicare, and we refer to them in D.C. as duly eligible beneficiaries, if there are, with the cuts that Congress is considering right now to Medicaid, that will put their access to cost-sharing assistance, to vision, dental, hearing, transportation services, that'll put all of those services at risk. In addition to nursing home services, which are predominantly covered by Medicaid, in-home long-term care services and supports, such as personal care attendants, home modifications, all of those benefits will be at risk for low-income seniors and individuals with disabilities if these Medicaid cuts go through. So there's that one sort of first direct impact. The secondary impact is, as Doug was saying, that when you do cut Medicaid, it increases costs, not only to Medicare, but also to the healthcare system in general. So, you know, the loss of access to things like cost sharing assistance and long-term care, all of those services that Medicaid covers really has the benefit of keeping low-income seniors and individuals with disabilities in their homes and out of hospitals. So if they no longer have access to those services, then we are anticipating to see Medicare costs go up. Similarly, as the governor was saying, I believe you said yesterday, this could have a very detrimental impact on the local healthcare system in general, so the providers and the hospitals. And then that means that everyone that seeks care in that local market could see their healthcare go up or their access be reduced. Mm-hmm.
I want to break it down a little bit.
But you know, Tim.
Yeah, go ahead.
Tim, for your listeners, right, who, I mean, when you take support away, many older adults are going to skip or delay care. And that's why what Christine is talking about is that the combination of Medicaid supports for low-income seniors means that you provide lower-cost services to them in the home to help them be well enough to stay in the home and get the support of their families and their neighbors, as opposed to seeing people get hospitalized. And then you have all these higher costs that are actually avoidable. And it just doesn't make sense from a fiscal stewardship perspective or a human loving, caring point of view either.
Well, and just to break it down in even more practical terms, there are some things that Medicaid pays for that Medicare simply does not. And that will really affect someone aging into Medicare or living with a long-term care need.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Go ahead, Christine.
Go ahead.
So exactly, you're right. So cost sharing for prescription drugs, for hospital co-payments, Medicare Part B, which covers your physician and your outpatient care, all of those services have cost-sharing components to them as well as premiums, and in addition to the prescription drugs. And it's Medicaid that covers that cost-sharing assistance, and that is significant for low-income seniors and individuals with disabilities.
Doug, your op-ed makes the point that, quote, cutting Medicaid is really cost shifting. I mentioned the governor's reaction. There were other state officials, federal officials in her press release yesterday reacting. How do federal and state budgets interact in this context? And what should taxpayers understand about who really pays the price here?
Well, I think that the Republican spending bill essentially takes away funding to support Medicaid. So Medicaid support for your listeners who depend on it, you know, 1 in 2 births in this country, 1 in 3 Americans, nearly 80 million people, adults with chronic conditions, and then seniors who are trying to remain independent into their homes. And also, this bill goes so far to impact people who work in small businesses and minimum wage, lower paying jobs. 10 million Americans lose Medicaid. You mentioned 8.6 becoming uninsured. This is about taking away from the most vulnerable amongst us and giving more to those with the greatest advantages. That's un-American. We're not taking care of each other. We're not supporting small businesses. We're not supporting families, and we're not supporting our aging parents. And I know the importance of Medicaid with my mom in the last few years of her life that helped her stay in the home. And I would have, my heart would have been ripped apart if she had not had the support that she needed to have dignity and health care as she aged and ultimately passed away last year.
I want to pick up on this point about the ripple effect that you're talking about for even for people not on Medicaid. What happens to provider networks or hospitals or rural clinics in the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, like areas like ours, when Medicaid dollars are pulled back?
Absolutely. Those cuts impact the whole healthcare delivery system. And as you know, some of the economic engines in small towns and rural communities are healthcare providers. These cuts will impact our local hospitals, our community clinics, labs, home care agencies. And then those cuts result in hospitals and clinics closing. This is going to impact providers like Sun River Health Community Health Center, which provides services up and down the Hudson in New York City and Long Island. Jobs are going to be lost. Services are going to be lost. We're going to have longer waiting lines, fewer specialists, and reduced care for beneficiaries.
Christy, do you want to address that too?
Yes, I agree with everything Doug said. And, you know, I would add to that, you know, people don't stop getting sick. They don't stop aging. They don't stop needing long-term care services or doctor's visits or prescription drugs. And so if, in addition to the impacts that Doug was saying, if they can no longer access their Medicaid services, not only do you see providers sometimes have to close down because they can no longer afford to stay, then that means no access or less access for everyone else living in that community. Also, that increases the bad debt that hospitals and other providers experience because they're no longer being reimbursed for those services from Medicaid. And then that bad debt translates into higher insurance costs for the rest of us.
Christine, so the early support for Medicaid shapes what kind of Medicare patient someone becomes at 65, right? So what's the long-term risk of destabilizing these dual eligibles before and after they transition into Medicare?
You know, it really is significant. And I think it's one of those things that, to Doug's point about seeing the benefits of Medicaid for his mom, that, you know, you really don't see it until it's your grandparents or your parents that are aging into Medicare or need long-term care services or have a disability and then therefore need and require these services. Another of our concern, in addition to reduced access, is a lot of these services, the Medicaid services, are intended to help keep people healthier and in the home, to delay the trajectory of their illness, and to just keep them healthier and in the community. Without that, you'll have exacerbation of their healthcare conditions or their long-term care needs, higher perhaps nursing home enrollment, more burden on families for informal caregiving. So this is really just all, it's such a, Medicaid is just such a pivotal player for all of us and our families. And we're very, very concerned really about the impact of these cuts.
You both work so closely with health plans and community-based care. Are there some innovations or best practices that are also at risk if Medicaid is scaled back? Doug?
You know, one of the biggest things, Tim, that is really at risk is addressing social determinants of health needs. You know, many times we're coming into the summer, July, August, and the heat goes up. And there are a lot of people who live in their home that have diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and they don't have air conditioning. And so when the temperature hits 100 degrees, a lot of times I see people being admitted to emergency rooms and hospitals over heat stroke and things that could have been prevented. So right now there are efforts to innovate around addressing social determinants of health where a health plan might be able to cover an air conditioner and some air conditioning in the hottest 2 months of the year, maybe at the cost of $400, $600, even $800 to prevent a $3,000 admission. The reality is that it's cheaper to promote wellness than to not promote wellness and end up paying for and addressing all kinds of chronic care needs that can only be addressed in the hospital or a nursing home. You know, there's a smart way to do this, and innovation is continuously needed in the Medicaid and the Medicare program. But if you got it, you got innovation as well.
And as NPR News was reporting, President Trump is on Capitol Hill right now, insisting that Republicans are not seeking cuts to benefit programs. He told reporters, quote, "We are not doing any cutting of anything meaningful. The only thing we're cutting is waste, fraud, and abuse with Medicaid, waste, fraud, and abuse," end quote. Well, final thoughts. What message would you most want the president and Congress to know about these cuts and this debate over Medicaid? Christine?
You know, I would say cutting benefits, Medicaid benefits to individuals and the impact that that will have on the Medicare program, on everyone else in the community, on their providers, is not waste, fraud, and abuse. And it's not an insignificant. These are real cuts if these bills go through, and it will have a real negative impact on people's lives.
And Doug?
I would say to your listeners, do not be fooled by political doublespeak. This is about taking from the most vulnerable amongst us and giving more to those with the greatest advantages. Don't be fooled by political doublespeak.
And if folks want to do something, what can they do? President lobbying Congress right now. Congress expected to go into recess before Memorial Day weekend. What's the best thing that folks can do at this point, really?
I would say to contact your local congressional leaders. You've got lots of listeners in districts 17, 18, and 19. Call your local office, go down, tell them that you don't want to see people hurt, you don't want to see Medicaid funding cut, you don't want people to lose healthcare access and become uninsured, that you don't support the actions that are being taken in Congress right now.
And Christine, anything else you'd like to add?
I agree completely. Call your members of Congress. Call your senators and let them know you do not support the Medicaid cuts, the Medicaid provisions in the reconciliation bill. You want them to vote no on the bill. And when the bill goes to the Senate, you want your senators to vote no.
That's Christine Aguiar Lynch, Vice President of Medicare and Managed Long-Term Services and Supports at the Association for Community Affiliated Plans, and Doug Wirth, President and CEO of AmidaCare, New York's largest Medicaid special needs health plan. Thank you both so much for joining us this morning at this critical moment and explaining what this all really means in real terms, practical terms for folks across the country. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the latest episode of Cat's Cast with Brett Barry, host and producer. This is Radio Chatskill.
You hear that? It's a musical picture of Havana late at night, played by the Perez Prado Orchestra. We'll hear it on this week's Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
Get ready to move, groove, and support public radio at the Radio Catskill Dance Party, Saturday, 7 to 11 p.m. at the Coshecton Pump House, featuring DJ sets from Jason Tugaw of The Mixtape and me, Jeff Barnes of Electric Mountain, spinning everything from funk to indie to house and more to get you dancing all night long. Good vibes, great music, and a portion of the night's proceeds support Radio Catskill, your local public radio station. The Radio Catskill Dance Party, Saturday, at the Coshecton Pump House.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels, small-batch handmade New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York, grizzlybagels.com, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In the latest episode of Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast, host and producer Brett Barry is taking us out to the ball game. But it's a revival of vintage baseball in Delaware County, New York. Brett Barry joins us this morning with a preview. Brett, hello.
Hello, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Tell us about this baseball. It's two words in this case, right?
Yeah, for the first many years of the sport, it was two words, baseball, B-A-S-E, space B-A-L-L. But in 1825... there is a claim that baseball made its first appearance in print, a game of baseball, in a Catskills newspaper, and in that occurrence, it was spelled BASS-BALL. So not many people were familiar with the game at that point, and spelling was an issue. And but the most surprising thing was that this ad, I guess, or announcement in a Delaware County newspaper was, many say, the first.
And is that the Delhi Vintage Baseball Club that was the first baseball club?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they had an official name. They were the Hamden, New York team. And in order to kind of bring attention to the new town of Hamden, they decided to have a baseball challenge and invited other players from Delaware County to come challenge them in their new town of Hamden, which is also celebrating its 200th birthday this summer.
And this mention in the paper, the Delaware Gazette, it really is important to the broader context of baseball history. This could truly have been the first documented organized game in the United States.
Yeah, there were probably some kind of improvisational games that happened earlier, but according to the captain of the vintage team that we interviewed for this story, and this has been known for some time now, this article is likely the very first that actually pinpoints a game with actual players' names. Times, dates, all that stuff.
And in the clip we're going to hear from this latest episode, you're talking to the captain of the Delhi Polecats, which is the current team that evolved from the Vintage Baseball Club. But they still play vintage baseball, and there's some different rules. There's a different equipment. There's different gameplay from the modern game.
Yeah, so the Polecats are one of three teams in Delaware County that play vintage baseball. There's the Delhi Polecats, the Bovina Dairymen, and the Mountain Athletic Club, or MAC, which plays on a historic field in Fleischmann's, New York. And they dress in period-appropriate uniforms that they have custom-made. The ball's a little softer. There's no gloves. And the rules are different. But don't ask me how, because I'm not a huge baseball fan, so I wouldn't probably know what the differences were. But there are, some definite differences from the modern sport, which they say are a lot of fun to watch.
Well, let me ask you this. What makes Delaware County the hotbed of vintage baseball? Three teams.
Yeah, that's a good question. So apparently there's about 200 vintage baseball games teams nationwide. Delaware County, I guess, got some nice fields there that also have historic relevance. Baseball was played on these fields for hundreds of years. And luckily, they haven't been built up, so they're still available for play in the exact spots where it happened long ago. So, and you'll hear in the interview that the captain of the team attributes COVID, of all things, to a bit of a resurgence. It was, vintage baseball was something that people could do. It was outdoors and reinvigorated the sport a little bit.
All right, let's take a listen to the latest episode of Cats Cast, focused on 1825 baseball, vintage baseball there in Delaware County, New York. Brett Berry, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim.
According to the Delaware County Vintage Baseball Association, vintage baseball, two words, is a loose term for amateur baseball played by the various rules, customs, and equipment of the 1800s. Men and women play with wooden bats, no gloves, and period-accurate attire. This summer marks the 200th anniversary of what some say is the first mention in print of any organized game of baseball, right here in the Catskills. On July 13th, 1825, nine residents of the newly established town of Hamden challenged an equal number of players from any town in Delaware County to play the game of baseball. Two centuries later, in July of 2025, vintage baseball is on deck as part of Hamden's own bicentennial celebration. We recently welcomed vintage baseball captain Drewski Landsman to our studio to field some questions about baseball's early appearance in an 1825 Catskills newspaper. But first, we wanted to know about his own vintage team, the Delhi Polecats.
We started in 2021. The pandemic was not great for most things, but it was kind of a boon for vintage baseball in the Catskills. Prior to that year, there had been three teams for vintage baseball in Delaware County. First was the Roxbury Nine, who sadly are not in operation anymore. You'll still see some guys come out in their Roxbury uniform and play with some of the other teams on certain days. But in 2020, there were two teams going, the Bovina Dairymen and the Fleischmann's MAC, or the Mountain Athletic Club, another team that has a direct tie to a 19th century name. Julius Fleischmann funded this team called the Mountain Athletic Club in the late 1800s. And both the Dairymen and the MAC have been going since around 2006, 7, 8. They had a pause after a flood in about 10 years ago, but were going strong prior to the pandemic. And in 2020, there were like hundreds of people coming to these games because there wasn't all that much to do. And this was an outdoor activity. And one of the captains of the Dairymen, a friend, or should I say frenemy, my good friend, Nick Franson, of the captain of the Dairymen. But he told me they were full up and I wouldn't be able to join. But he said, keep an eye out. We might be starting a third team. And a gentleman by the name of Ben Cairns, who grew up in Delhi and was on the Dairymen for a couple of years, the honor was foisted upon him to go and start a third Delaware County team. So in 2021, we began simply as the Delhi Vintage Baseball Club. We didn't have a set home field as of yet. We played some games at the Delaware County Historical Museum. We played some games at the Legion Field. And we started playing a few games at the historic Crawford Field in Hamden, New York. Since then, we've been leaning more and more into our Hamden heritage. This is the first year we're really being known as the Hamden Nine. But it's a very special year in Hamden. It's the bicentennial for the town, and it's also the bicentennial of the game in print as we see it, listing players' names as well as any sum of money associated with the game, that being the sum of $1 per game posted in an article in 1825.
So baseball, the history of baseball comes with a lot of dates attached to it. And, well, according to AI-powered Google search, it looks like the first organized game took place in Hoboken in 1846. Would you dispute that?
Well, of course. Yeah, that's part of why I'm here. That has been long recognized, the Elysian Fields game, as it was known. The story goes that the city was, well, it was undergoing the throes of the Industrial Revolution. The air was terrible in Manhattan. The gentlemen of New York City would literally take a ferry across to Hoboken and play on those fields. There's a figure amongst that group known as Doc Adams that a lot of people in the vintage baseball community today are trying to get into the Hall of Fame. He's known for inventing the idea of the shortstop, helping to codify how bats are shaped and baseballs are made and stuff like that. But he was known for also hitting balls at the Elysian Fields into the Hudson River. And this is a big deal because, you know, balls were pretty hard to come by back then.
Where would you place that date for the first organized baseball game?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 1825, July, shortly after the famous notice was placed in the Delaware Gazette. I would surmise that there were organized games that took place even before 1825, being that from our claim, where we're the first time you see actual players' names listed in print, there's a little bit more organization happening. And so shortly after July 12th, 1825, when this article was brought to the Gazette and then printed, presumably nine other guys from somewhere else in Delaware County showed up in Hamden and played at the home of Edward B. Chase, which is why we call our annual event, the Edward B. Chase Baseball Challenge.
And that challenge, was that an attempt to bring publicity to the town, this new town of Hamden?
In 1825, Hamden had been founded in the spring of that year, mostly from the neighboring towns of Delhi and Walton. And so I think, yes, exactly, to sort of put Hamden on the map, to state their claim, they printed this notice saying, we'll take nine players from any other town in the county, or if nine players from one town cannot be founded, you can make up nine players from several towns. So they're basically saying, we know we're really good at this game. We want to invite you to come see us in our new town and play us for the sum of a dollar per player or per game. But a dollar back then was about 30 some odd dollars today. So nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah. So let me read this. This is published in the July 13th, 1825 edition of the Delaware Gazette, page 3, and it says, a challenge. The undersigned, all residents of the new town of Hamden, with the exception of Asa C. Howland, who was ostracized for some reason, it says here he was recently removed into Delhi, so I guess that disqualified him, challenge an equal number of persons of any town in the county of Delaware to meet them at any time at the house of Edward B. Chase, in said town, to play the game of baseball, spelled B-A-S-S-ball, for the sum of $1 each per game, which is about $32 today. If no town can be found that will produce the required number, they have no objection to play against any selection that could be made from the several towns in the county. Signed, Eli Bagley, Edward B. Chase, Harry P. Chase, Ira Peak, Walter C. Peak, H.B. Goodrich, R.F. Thurber, Asa C. Howland, M.L. Bostwick. Hamden, July 12th, 1825. What do you know about these guys?
So some of them are well recorded because they are the first town clerk, the first constable. One of the Chase brothers was a tavern keeper, probably the most respected person in town, the one serving the ales. They're all recorded in the early days of Hamden. I think the question about Asa is, was he originally part of Hamden and then moved back to Delhi, or maybe they changed the lines, you know, but clearly he's still part of the team. He's listed there. The thing to note, which is kind of interesting, is that the idea of nine players on a team had not been set in stone and would not be set for another decade or two. I think maybe by that Elysian Fields game we talked about in the 1840s, nine became the convention. So it's kind of coincidental that we have nine players listed here. It helps our cause as staking Hamden as the home of baseball in print. We're still looking to find out if the opposing players' names were recorded anywhere.
Do you know what the results of that game were?
We do not.
Okay. There was no follow-up article.
No, you'll see the same article printed the next week. So we can assume that the game did not happen within the first week. I would assume that it did happen by the end of August. You know, things moved pretty slow back then. My idea also with the BASS spelling. So first off, baseball was two words as a convention until probably the 1880s or 1890s. It became one word over time. As we know today, obviously it's just one word. But it was B-A-S-E space B-A-L-L. In this article, it was printed B-A-S-S, and a lot of people will say basketball. I think maybe the person that was writing this down was maybe a musician. And so when he heard Edward B. Chase or whoever came to deliver the message say baseball, he wrote B-A-S-S base. That's really, you know, a minor dispute. You'll hear locals say the basketball challenge sometimes. You know, Hampton's not a place that's looking for a ton of hoopla, not most years anyway. I've heard that from the current town clerk. But this year is the 200th anniversary. I think we're inviting people to come see what Hampton's all about this July 12th and 13th. There'll be a town parade on the morning of the 12th that the Hampton Nine and some other baseball players of vintage caliber will be part of. And there'll be 8 different teams from all over New York State, as well as one from Connecticut, joining us at both Crawford Field, where we normally play, and we're also going to put in two fields across Route 10 down the way. We're going to call them the Chase Brothers Flats in honor of Harry P. and Edward B. But vintage baseball's been taking off in Delaware County. The Dairymen over at Creamery Field have been hosting something called the Cowtown Scramble every October now for a few years, and it's been attracting teams from further away. There was a team from Maine that came to visit last year. There's been a team from Maryland up. The Dairymen have done a great job of spreading the word, as have the MAC, both, you know, with really deep historic ties. We've only been around, this is our 5th year in existence. The year after we started, both the Saugerties, now called Brickmakers, and the Kingston Guards started in 2022. And they've done a really great job of getting some historically vintage uniforms and beating the drum for the cause. You know, it's nice to have people not super, super far away. There's about an hour's drive between our two areas, but we welcome the Brickmakers and Guards as often as we can up to Crawford Field.
So is this another challenge? Are you challenging these teams for this bicentennial event? And are you charging them a dollar to participate?
Today we charge nothing. We charge nothing to anybody. The admission's always free for all fans. For my players, I ask for commitment or time only. I mean, time is such a premium these days, as we know. One of the things I love about this endeavor is just it's a way to connect with each other and to be off of my phone, to be off of any kind of screen and just engage in something real. We have a foot in the past and a foot in the future. We do try to get the word out on social media. It's tough these days to cut through the noise.
What makes your team special?
Aside from the 200th year, I think what's special about the Polecats, the Hampton Nine, we kind of have an underdog spirit. You know, as the team that kind of spun off from these two established other teams in the county, we're not expected to win usually. We eke out some here and there. We've gotten a lot better over our first 4 years. The Dairymen especially have become known as sort of the team to beat. But it's really about having a good time and connecting with each other, connecting with the history of the sport, and something special about the Catskills, too. Sometimes we go and play in one of the home fields for the, say, the Brooklyn Atlantics or the New York Mutual, and they'll play in historic villages within places where as soon as you walk away from the field, you're back in the modern day. And, you know, a lot of our fields are really set in a rural, rustic, you know, environment. So it brings an extra element of vintage to the sport.
Now, what can you tell me about the town of Hampton and its own celebration?
So they've got a 5K run coming. There is a covered bridge in Hampton, which is truly picturesque. About a mile long is the main street, which is part of Route 10. It's halfway between Delhi and Walton. It's a great spot. You know, at any time of year, you'll find some fun going on there. But I think this year especially, you'll see much more than they're used to in Hampton. And I appreciate that they've gotten a bicentennial community together. You know, it's a beautiful day for Hampton, for sure.
You know, you've mentioned all these teams. It seems like the Catskills are kind of a hotbed for vintage baseball. Is that true, or is this happening everywhere?
There are a couple hundred teams across the country. I think COVID really helped for us for this particular thing. I think, as we all know, the Catskills have sort of experienced some sort of, I don't want to say a boom economy, but a lot more people are living up here full time since 2020. And I think that's helped the cause. Some people might totally disagree with me. Some people on my own team might disagree with me, and that's fine. You know, not everybody sees eye to eye up here. I've always seen the Catskills as sort of a microcosm of what's going on around the country. I myself am a hybrid creature. I was very lucky to grow up in both the city and the country, and I've felt more at home in Delaware County. And still, I feel like an outsider, too. But the truth is, it's the Catskills are so vast. You know, what happens in the Hudson Valley and in Sardis and Kingston doesn't necessarily trickle over Bel Air Mountain. We're over there in the quote-unquote Great Western Catskills. It's so beautiful up here, and it's so majestic to be able to go to something like this and feel the history, see a fun sport. It's a fun thing to do, and we welcome everybody. I think it's really something you got to experience for yourself. Whether you're in Saugerties in Kingston or on the west, or if you're closer to the city, find a vintage baseball game this year. Go check it out. You might be pleasantly surprised. You might find yourself hooked. And we're open to anyone, men and women, boys and girls, all ages. The sport needs players and it needs enthusiasts. Most years we have a couple dates at Hamden. This year we're doing the full weekend in Hamden. All our other dates are away dates. So we'll be in Saugerties on June 1st. We're playing at the Meredith Dairy Fest the following weekend. We'll go down to Kingston. We're actually playing at the Aerodrome against the Guards third week of June. And we'll be at Bovina and Fleischmann's later in July. We're trying to get down to Long Island for a Doc Adams Festival. We mentioned that historical figure in early August. And then kind of take a break. August is a tough time to corral the Polecats. But we'll be back around for the Cowtown Scramble in October.
More information on Hamden's bicentennial celebration at hamden1825.org. For CatsCast and WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Berry.
You can hear the full episode of CatsCast and previous episodes at catscast.com or wherever you get your podcasts, including our website, wjffradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, how the Pike County Conservation District is protecting the waters in the county and inspiring youth. This is Radio Catskill. Hi, I'm Tim Bruno, General Manager at Radio Catskill. Hudson Valley Gives is tomorrow, and we need you. Your donation helps keep trusted news, diverse voices, and local culture on the air for everyone. Now more than ever, your support makes a difference. Give where you live. Go to hvgives.org and donate to Radio Catskill. We are navigating uncertainty with the strength of our community behind us. Donate at hvgives.org. Thanks.
This week on This American Life, Alicia was out of a job when she started making wigs for pets. And she decided, this is going to be my thing, which worked.
He said, okay, let me see him. And I put him on the desk. The first thing he said was, great, I'd like to place an order. Let's launch at Halloween.
Not good news. Turned out to be not entirely good news this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This summer, local youth have a unique opportunity to get their feet wet, literally, while learning about the vital role clean water plays in our environment. Stream Keepers is a free hands-on program offered by the Pike County Conservation District, inviting kids ages 11 to 14 and their chaperones to explore stream health through interactive activities like macroinvertebrate surveying, fly tying, and fly casting. Here to tell us more about what those words mean, Rachel Marks and Emily Mansfield of the Pike County Conservation District. Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know if it's too early for me to say macro invertebrate. I need more coffee. Tell us a little bit more about the Stream Keepers program. What is it, and what inspired the creation?
So the Stream Keepers program is actually originally a program that was created by Trout Unlimited. And it comes from, the intent was originally, I think, to target Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, through one of the chapters of Trout Unlimited in Pennsylvania. And they are kind enough to share the resources with, anybody who would like to use them. And we were one of those groups that would want to use them and try to bring that program here to Pike and Wayne counties. It is, like you said, for youth ages 11 to 14 was the target audience when they originally created the program. That original program was through Trout Unlimited. We're lucky to have them as a partner to help us put this all together.
What makes this particularly beneficial to that age group, that target audience?
So the information that we're going to present is very, targeted to that age group. So, and it's really good. Like you had mentioned, we're going to have some really hands-on demonstrations. Fly tying, Trout Unlimited is really, really great at having a fly tying demonstration. Their members are great, and they have a little interactive thing where the kids can choose the colors of feathers on their fly, and they get to take one home. They also have some great fly casting demonstrations as well. And we have the equipment to let some kids get in the stream and check out some of our microinvertebrate friends. So
let's talk a little bit more about macroinvertebrate. What is what is macroinvertebrate surveying? Explain it, please.
Yeah, I say macroinvertebrate like 30 times a day, so I guess I'm used to it. But macroinvertebrates, they are small but still visible with the naked eye, basically stream insects. And they're really sensitive to a variety of stream conditions. So we like to use them as what we call a bioindicator, or this group of animals can help us make assumptions about the stream health overall. And they're fun to find in the stream. Kids love seeing them. And so we kind of use them to talk about stream health and get some kids with some bugs in their hands, which they enjoy as well. So it's really fun time for everybody.
So explain that a little bit more about how that identification help folks understand stream health. How do the activities like that, macroinvertebrate identification and fly tying, accomplish that?
So macroinvertebrates are, like I said, they're very sensitive, but they're also a really important part of the food chain. So a lot of times when our Trout Unlimited folks are doing the fly tying, they are mimicking some of these macroinvertebrates, what they look like, to try to get the fish to think, hey, this is a cool snack, you know, like we do with some of our other fishing lures and stuff like that. That's one of the ways that it helps us talk about stream health. And then they do live in the stream, so it's really fun. We get to get actually in the stream and look for them under rocks and stuff.
At the Pike County Conservation District, you guys do more than just, go out in the water. There's a broader environmental work effort happening there, including out of the water, the Dirt, Gravel, and Low-Volume Road Program. Talk about that and how important it is to conservation in the county.
Sure, yeah. So the Dirt, Gravel, and Low-Volume Road Program is administered by our program manager here at the district. And that's a larger program that is out of the Penn State Center for Dirt, Gravel, and Low-Volume Road Studies. So one of the main things that we focus on here in the district through a variety of programs is keeping sediment out of our surface waters or our streams. Sediment is actually the number one pollutant in our Pennsylvania waterways, which is kind of surprising when we think about pollutants. Sometimes we think about trash or chemicals or stuff like that, but sediment or soil, when it's on the land surface, is a really great resource, but when it ends up in the waters, it can create problems by clogging the gills of fish or those macroinvertebrates that Rachel was describing, and it can just lower the quality of the water overall. So through that Dirt, Gravel, and Low-Volume Roads program, we hope to provide technical assistance and funding to public road entities. So that would be municipalities, the State Game Commission, anywhere that owns a publicly owned road, to help stabilize their road and make sure that the soil is staying in place and out of nearby streams.
This one's kind of for the big kids, right? So,
Yes. So we work really closely with a lot of our townships and boroughs, mostly on that program.
So for a program like that, and then something for children, like what's the community response been so far for your overall conservation efforts in Pike County?
Yeah, we work with lots of different groups. You put it well, for kids and for big kids as well. So we get to interact with a lot of different stakeholders in the community, which is great. Through school groups like our Streamkeepers program, but also municipalities, and also through many of the other nonprofit and government organizations in the area. We work very closely with Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, or DEP, and the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, DCNR, who owns our state forests and state parks. We do a lot of programs with them, as well as a lot of the other nonprofit and educational organizations in our area, too. And so it gives us a good opportunity to reach out to lots of different community members, and we always get really good feedback from pretty much everyone that we interact with.
Let's talk about logistics and participation for Streamkeepers and DGLVR, if I'm using the appropriate lingo there in the Conservation yeah. District. How do folks get more information about these programs, and how can they participate?
Yeah, so for the Stream Keepers program, we have a registration. So we do have a limited registration for that just because it is so hands-on. We want to make sure we have enough materials for everybody. And that does have a free lunch as well. So we have a registration on our website, and or they could call us with any questions. And then for the Dirt and Gravel Low Volume Roads program, the DGLVR, we love our acronyms here. That is a more of a grant type of program. Uh-huh. So you can reach out to our office. We do have information on our website as well, but our program coordinator that Emily had mentioned is the ideal person to talk to about that program.
Yeah, so that DGLVR program, the grants are only available to public road entities, like I mentioned, municipalities or the state. But we do have lots of educational resources for any other members of the community that are interested in learning more about the impact. We can connect you with some before and after photos and the website for that greater program. And usually when we have projects completed or underway, we'll keep photos of that on our Facebook and Instagram pages.
I like what you guys say on your social media, your website. We all live downstream. So great that you guys are protecting all the downstream environment for us in so many different ways. That's Rachel Marks and Emily Mansfield of the Pike County Conservation District. And there's more information at pikeconservation.org. Thank you both so much.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
All right. And before we go, a reminder that it's election day, believe it or not. In New York, the state law requires that school budget votes and elections occur on the third Tuesday in May. That's today. If you go to our website under community announcements, the bottom of the main page there, you'll see a list of some of the school budget and board of education candidates for Sullivan County, New York. There are also links to other counties in the state as well. And it's election day in Northeast Pennsylvania. It's primary election day. In fact, throughout the entire state, if you go to the website, wjffradio.org, on the right-hand side, you'll see some of the localized races that are up in the area in Wayne County. There are votes for the magistral district judge 22-3-02, Wayne Highlands School District, Cherry Ridge Township Supervisor. Pike County has a magisterial district judge at a Delaware Valley School District, and there are other resources listed, including Wayne County, Pike County, Lackawanna, Luzerne County links, and also a link to the Pennsylvania Department of State for the primary election today. The election goes through 8 o'clock. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Whether Radio Catskill brings a smile to your day, some inspiration, or a greater connection to the Catskills and Northeast PA, we're proud to be here with you. Federal funding, about $1.60 per person annually, helps keep these trusted services strong and accessible to everyone in our community. Learn how you can safeguard local public media stations like ours by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, being a documentary filmmaker used to mean taking a vow of poverty. Then came streaming.
I'm told between 30 and 40 million people saw that movie.
We talked with the filmmaker R.J. Cutler, who's behind some of the biggest documentary films in recent years. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, increasing clouds, maybe some sun this afternoon. Cool and rainy for the rest of the week, though. There could be some gradual improvement over the holiday weekend. Today's high 57, tonight cloudy, a low of 45. Tomorrow, rain and drizzle in the evening, high of only 49. Thursday's high 44, but warming up to 52. Again, showers through Friday, 51 for Saturday. And on Sunday, 57, partly sunny and cool, maybe 60 by Monday.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.